I mean, I think that it's rather like Philip was saying. I think the problem we've got, the crisis in music theatre, it seems to me, from my limited experience, having seen about eight of them, is that...
Yeah, but they were all really lousy, weren't they?
No, no, I really enjoyed the Big Life, actually. I'll talk about that in a sec. But I think that... most people in Britain, Arts Council leaflet that I read last year, goes to the theatre three times in their lives, right? So it's nice that there's a museum for it, but it's not really relevant to most people. They go three times in their lives. The people that go three times in their lives, you can reasonably assume that one of the things they're going to go and see will be something at the moment like We Will Rock You, the Queen musical we've been out on Queen. When you think about West End shows, the overheads are so high that you're looking at least £25 a ticket, probably as much as £45, £50. If you're a young person in the greatest city in the world, which is London, there are so many things you can go and see that cost £5 or £10 that are all much better than the average musical and far more exciting. You're not going to go. The other thing about that £45 wedge is that it places a whole weight of expectation on what the evening is, right? I think that when people go out to something of that expense, it becomes a night out, right? And what they probably want from it is not the same as what we might imagine theatre is for, right? We might imagine that theatre and the arts generally are to ask questions, stimulate debate, and show people ideas they might never have thought of that will stimulate them in some way or surprise them or shock them. If people have spent a lot of money for a night out, what they probably want is something that they already know or care about reconfirmed to them and bounce back at them. They don't want to be distressed, unsettled, or have an argument. Although, perversely, one of the only controversial plays that's been in the West End for the last 10 years was Oleanna by David Mamet. The marketing actually went guaranteed to make you and your partner argue afterwards, so they had to actually sell that as as an argument's part of the package of your big night out. So I think there's a problem basically with the kind of people that are spending the money for that sort of night out. They don't want to be exposed to the kind of things that tend to make good theatre, which are some level of confusion, controversy, bewilderment, and surprise. The other vacuum that creates is when you look at a show like We Will Rock You or the Rod Stewart musical. Part of why those work is because they hit an exact demographic group, like Philip was saying, which is people probably in their 40s and 50s who have that kind of money to spend. Weirdly, the Madness musical, based on the songs of Madness, which is quite good, actually, that didn't run as long as one would have expected to, and I think it's exactly because Madness fans are 7 years younger than Queen fans and Rod Stewart fans and predominantly working class, so have less money to spend. And it's as simple as that. What I would worry about for the Big Life is I thought it was absolutely fantastic in as much as it communicated, it was specifically about immigration in the 50s into Britain. It used ska and old reggae, which I've never seen used in a musical before, and it just was fantastic for patter songs, to the point where I began thinking that perhaps all musicals should be on the offbeat and based around 1950s Jamaican rhythms in future. It seemed to be the only... It was a great way of having, you know... And, but also, it spoke directly to a 95% black working class audience in that who were very excited to have their exact concerns addressed, but in a way that was aggressive, and they were talking about those signs in the 50s, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs in British pubs. That sentence alone was more stimulating than anything in any other musical I've ever seen, right? To hear that said on the stage. And when I was in the car park afterwards, there were loads of people going, I hope it transfers to the West End. And I thought, well, maybe the thing to do would be to tour it around former areas of immigration in the British Isles and give those people a fantastic experience. And because I think when you hit this West End audience with their expectations, they might, even though it's a very, very exciting show, they might on some level be confused because it's not as simple a prospect as We Will Rock You, which is basically like a children's show. You know, so it's a slippery notion, and I wish you the best of luck with it because it was excellent, but, you know.
I'm pleased you liked it, and I liked your show as well. It's very interesting that in the two shows that in these two shows, you hadn't seen a musical before, and the composer of The Big Life had never seen a musical before anywhere when he wrote that show.
Right.
And even though it seems a fairly conventionally plotted musical, but of course he was the composer, and that I find very interesting. The advice is not never see a musical and try and write one. Can't give you advice. But what is interesting is that with the musical theatre workshops we've been now doing for six years, every July, for the whole of July, and they're workshops where two people come over from the Tisch School in New York and work with people, half of whom have never seen the musical. I mean, enticing them, the difficult trick of enticing people to come into a workshop when they haven't seen a musical to learn about writing musicals is a difficult one to pull. But once you get the word out and it becomes known, oh, it's a good 4 weeks, and it's a very practical course indeed. And half the people coming to that by happy accident, we don't sort of choose in this way, at least half are usually black, a quarter are usually Asian, and a quarter white, is very roughly the composition of the people that have been coming to those. And a lot of them have never been involved. And what is interesting is that an awful lot of the best of the talent that's coming out of that had never seen a musical before. Had they gone to the West End and seen an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical, for example, and he's a very good writer, but they would never come to our course. If they thought, oh, that's what a musical is, all white on stage usually, all white in the audience as well, that world, there's no place for me, there's no connection. As you've said in particular, with the material of The Big Life, it does connect directly with people's experience. And it is astonishing, isn't it? We didn't do it for this reason, and it wasn't until after it opened. I think it was a review of yours that pointed the way to the thought, when I realised, after it was open, that when it goes to the West End, it will be the first black British musical ever in the West End.
Reflecting black contemporary experience.
Precisely. People say, what about Five Guys' Name? No, it's American.
Which also came from Stratford East.
Yes, indeed. And we started rehearsing that. We only had Act One, actually. That's one that we
learned
quickly, very fast. It was a compilation musical, and it was, in a way, simple to direct, too.
Yeah.
But with The Big Life, you're absolutely right, because at Stratford, I mean, some nights you couldn't tell whether there was more black or white people in the audience. And the audience was, being the resonance of the show was much greater when the audience was mixed in race and age and class. I believe that's always true of any show. And it is going to be immensely important. And in a way, we have to crack the West End open to bring that audience in, because the black audience has not been. They did not go in, the black audience, to see Five Guys Named Moe. Mm. Here's a piece of their history, though, for the first time, something they relate with directly. And at Stratford East, in the time I've been there, the thing I'm most proud of is the audience, actually.
Yeah.
And it's the best reviewed audience in British theatre. It constantly gets reviews. But that only goes to show how rare those critics see that kind of audience in any other theatre, which is a bad thing.
I mean,
we have to find a way of cracking it open.
Though, why do you have to go into the West End in order for the musical to be legitimate? I mean, why does it not get it?
Well, this is an odd. This is an odd. You know,
but do you need to do it to reach a bigger public?
I think. With us, there was an amount spent on it in collaboration with the National Theatre that could probably only be recouped if it went into this kind of this kind of commercial space. It's not subsidised anyway, so I suppose that's why. But there are odd assumptions made, I think, about when a piece has reached its achievement. There's this kind of for example, Broadway is the logical endpoint for a musical. That's seen as the achievement. But if you go and see a random selection of shows there's nothing on there that makes you feel like the form's at its most refined. In fact, it has the same problems that we have in terms of audience, but worse, because tickets there are three times as much as they are here. So you're playing to an even I think you're playing to an even narrower strata of people.
Well, and, I think you're right there. So I think the West End needs a show like The Big Life much more than The Big Life needs the West End. There's no question of that. And the West End, it must have new musicals coming in. It must have new musicals coming in which represent what London is about. And it's fascinating to me. Here's a show about immigrants, black immigrants in the 50s. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, about a third of London now is ethnic minority, so-called. well, here's the show that we have about immigrants. I would imagine that it's probably half the people in London, either they are immigrants themselves, or that one of their parents were, or one of their grandparents were. I would imagine 50% of London would come into that category. And that's an awful lot of people who would identify with a show like that, because we found it's the immigrant experience in London which the audience identify with, and people from other races, white people from parts of Europe, as you know, they identify with it as well.
So that's the audience. But can we just backtrack to the creative process that brought that show about? I mean, you were speaking about the workshop that that you do every summer. However, you are a composer who'd never been near a musical before.
Mm-hmm.
But he's from a reggae band, wasn't
That's
he?
Right.
But then you put him with an experienced playwright, in fact, literary manager of the RSC, Paul Sarratt.
We had had four plays by Paul Sarratt. His first four plays were at our theatre.
Right.
He is now literary manager of the RSC. Talked earlier about where do ideas for musical come from. I mean, that was such a neat thought. That
Love's Labour's Lost.
How do you make Love's Labour's... It's a ludicrous story anyway, a great ludicrous story. How do you make that work today? Why would people forswear women, drink, etc.? Coming across on the boat from the Caribbean in the 50s to the mother country, the big life in the mother country, that's where they forswear. So as he saw the connection between Love's Labour's Lost and ska, because he was in a ska revival band in the early 80s. What's interesting about the show, too, though, is that the combination of somebody who had seen a lot of musicals, and knew the virtues of Guys and Dolls, for example, and put him, and he came with the idea to me. I put him with the other Paul Joseph, who'd never seen a musical but had done our course and wrote the music, and put the two of them with somebody who had to be the director who had never directed before.
Right.
At that time, this is his first show he's ever directed. He's an actor. He's done a director's course at our theatre, etc. And indeed, in saying to him, the only things I'd take credit for the creation of that musical, apart from starting the workshops, would be obviously putting the three people together concerned. And secondly, I did say to the director, look, all the time, Clint, that when you're creating that show as a trio, you keep in mind that what I want as a producer is a show that will entertain your parents. Because they lived in the borough, Clint lived in the borough near the theatre, they'd come over at that time from the Caribbean. And I said, if you do it, that's what I want. Think of nothing else. Just will your parents enjoy it?
So we've got new blood.
The West End certainly wasn't in mind.
So we have new blood in the writing of it. We have new blood in the audience coming to see it.
Yes.
But musical theatre, of course, doesn't exist in a vacuum. I mean, it has to have some kind of context.
It does appear to exist in a vacuum, doesn't it? Because compared to any other form of theatre, it doesn't, as a genre, it doesn't really take on much of the innovations that happen in other areas of art. It does seem hermetically sealed in some way. It's quite, you know, again, whenever I see one, I think, how can you possibly do that in 2004? Richard, for example, he draws on a vast range of different styles of music, like someone who's mad would. But he doesn't, it's sort of, there's just, he doesn't see them as mutually exclusive, stylistically, and rams them all together. And it does seem that a lot of the ones you see, that's very, they do seem very isolated from other developments. And one of the things that we were lucky with, I think, in terms of existing in a vacuum, is that all the little tricks that we've learnt in 15 years of doing fringe comedy to fringe audiences that anyone can do that's from that kind of background of just some degree of irony or double meaning or a clash of styles or sudden shifts of mood, all those things you use on no budget, when we contextualise them within West End commercial theatre, they suddenly seem far more radical than they actually were, because loads of those things just don't find their way in. So I think it probably, and oddly, being in the Edinburgh Fringe, when we did the show in the Edinburgh Fringe, there are 1,500 shows on every day in Edinburgh, in the Fringe, and almost without exception, all the music theatre performers in our show only went to see musicals, right, in Edinburgh. And that was a point where they could have been exposed to a wide variety of different things. So I think it's very inward-looking.
Well, one of the interesting things about Edinburgh is that it's there are in the Fringe program, there are only 6 pages devoted to musical theatre out of those 1,500 shows. So actually musical theatre is very narrowly represented in Edinburgh. It's not actually reflective of the West End, where actually probably half the shows now are musicals. I mean, Julius, as a producer, why do you think the musical dominates the West End as it does?
Well, I mean, one of the reasons that the West End stays alive at all is because of all these 40-odd theatres that we have, and the problem that we have with them, that they're listed buildings and they can only be used for theatre work. Within that, there is a portion of them that are of a size that really do only suit musical theatre, because they were built as music hall or variety halls or whatever. They're not good for presenting plays in. Therefore, you have commercial managements who are sitting with these buildings, the only possible use for which is to put not just theatre, but musical theatre into them.
It's interesting because we have buildings in the New York City that the mandate is not the same. I mean, they could be knocked down very easily if there weren't someone filling them, and yet the proportions are identical.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it accounts for a lot of the musical theatre product that we see, because whenever a crazy millionaire walks into a theatre owner's office and says, I want to spend £2 million on this idea I have, they are going to encourage that. And I think that is something from which this industry suffers at the moment, the need to fill buildings and the need to fill it with a certain sort of product. It's a very commercial imperative from the owners of those buildings. And when people have these ideas, they don't necessarily give them the best advice. They simply encourage them to sign the theatre lease and get on with their concept, whatever it might be. And that is why, for all the image of success generated by a few hits in the 80s, statistically, London is a graveyard of musical theatre.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I mean, it's, you know, what was interesting about talking about how musical theatre is a vacuum, and certainly on a writing level, it does seem to be that. And you know, the smarter of us who work in it all have acknowledged that for a long time. But the interesting thing is the reason I asked why you have to legitimize a show by putting it in the West End is I'm playing devil's advocate with myself in a large part. The reason that all my shows have to go to Broadway is because I have to make a living. I mean, you know, the reason I have to do work that is that commercially accessible and play houses that are that large is because I only get a piece of every ticket that gets sold. And the other proportion of that is all the other people on Broadway feel exactly the same way, which is to say, if I want to work with the best people in the business, I have to work with people who are working in large enough venues that support the fees that they command. And those people want to work sort of at the top level. They want to work technologically in the places where they're going to spend the money to do the things right and where it's going to look right. And they know, you know, the best advertising and all the best sort of people that you can work with are working at that level, even though, bizarrely, the writing doesn't support it. I mean, the writing supports the genre just fine. You know, the writing is supporting, you know, there are plenty of musicals that are going and are all making plenty of money. And when I saw The Woman in White the other night, the theater was full. So, you know, it's doing fine by itself. We can just talk about the crisis until our eyes turn green, but it's not going to do anything about the fact that everyone's going. But the best people are still... And the best theater artists, even those who don't work exclusively in musicals, the best theater artists still want to get paid, and they want to get paid as much as they can. And I think that accounts for why things have to gravitate that way to be legitimized.
Well, I mean, I don't think any sort of theater, musical or otherwise, has to go to the West End. I think that aim is a red herring. And I think the West End is a cutthroat commercial marketplace with its own agenda, and necessarily high ticket prices that do in fact reflect the cost of production. And I think many forms of theatre are better off outside the West End. I mean, I for many years was involved in producing a musical called Saucy Jack and the Space Fixins.
Which in lots of site-specific places.
Lots of places. Tents, bars, Edinburgh Fringe, many times. We bought a nightclub for it where it ran for almost 3 years. It didn't make huge bucks, but it made a living. The one mistake we made was to bring it into the West End.
Where it devalued the product.
Where it devalued the product, and it lost £1 million in 12 weeks. because it was the wrong show in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah,
it's still very successful in its own context as an alternative musical that gets by in bars and clubs.
I think the good thing about getting stuff into the West End, though, is that I think there's something of you're talking about a crisis in music theatre. I think there's a crisis in British culture at the moment, in as much as since BBC Two became about decorating rather than arts and documentaries and whatever, and the BBC moved all culture onto BBC Four. In radio, they've done a similar thing where you have to have a digital radio now to pick up specialist shows. So all culture has been marginalised. So increasingly, I think if you have an interesting idea, you have to think of a way of disguising it as a mainstream idea in order to expose it to an audience and take them by surprise. You know, I heard Howard Jacobson talking once about how when there was only BBC One, his father, who was not an educated man, would accidentally find himself watching Verdi on television and quite enjoy it. But now that will not happen because A, it's not there on a mainstream channel, and it's been compartmentalised in such a way as it's given the culture label, which scares people off. One of the things I think we're proud about Springer is that it has got operatic voices in it, and it's also got weird, fringe, marginalised comedy. And both those things are not stuff that the person that goes to the theatre three times in their life would normally seek out. And yet hundreds of them every week are being accidentally exposed to the very high and low end of culture at the same time, which they would never normally arrive at. And are normally going away having enjoyed it. And I think you have to kind of do it by cover actions, and that's kind of one of the last places since the BBC abandoned its commitment to the values that it was set up with. One of the kind of last places that you're going to sneak things in is via mainstream theatre, and oddly I think that's going to become increasingly important. You know, for example, if the Big Life comes into the West End, that means that tourists will go and see it, that people that go out for their one night a year out of theatre will be exposed to a specifically black musical drawing from black music, at the same time that the BBC have decided that the best place for all black culture is on a one radio station that you can only buy if you buy a special radio. So, you know, there's things are travelling in different directions at the same time.
And it ought to be, I mean, in subsidised theatre, and still, I think, in Britain, the percentage of money in the subsidised theatres, there's much greater percentage comes from the government than, say, happens in the States, where you're lucky if you get 10%.
Oh, well, and for a commercial show, you'll get nothing.
Yeah. It ought to be, of course, the famous right to fail, so that one isn't always thinking, we've got to have a West End success, so we've got to package it like all the previous West End successes, etc., which can be very inhibiting. And I think with musical theatre, though, with subsidy, it's interesting that the Arts Council has never been able to cope with musical theatre. It falls somewhere between the music department and the theatre department, and it just falls in between the two. And I still think there's innate elitism at the Arts Council, despite all that they publish, because musicals, I mean, they're populist, aren't they?
The argument that they make money anyway.
Yeah, they're probably commercial. Yeah. They're a bit at the dirty end. They're not proper art, really. When in fact it's an extremely difficult art form, because as was said earlier, the collaboration necessary to create it makes it a very difficult art form to bring off. And I haven't noticed, it's interesting, isn't it, they'll give 3 million, I think, last year to Classical Music Research and Development Centre in Aldborough or whatever, when they have been religiously not supporting our venture for creating new musicals. And I think if the Big Life goes into the West End, this was a journalist that said this, it ought to have underneath it unsupported by the Arts Council.
But of course, if it does go into the West End, then it will make money and they'll say, well, we didn't need to support it anyway.
Yes, exactly.
So you're damned if you do, damned if you don't.
But in terms of agendas, I think we have to remind ourselves that the subsidised sector and the BBC do have obligations to reach certain audience sectors and to promote perhaps homegrown work as well. But we also, in contrast to that, have to be realistic about the West End, which is what we're talking about, in that commercial producers don't have any such obligations or indeed agendas other than to follow their own taste, put on a good show and return a profit for their investors.
Exactly. Yeah, although I think that there's something that to be said for training up an audience, developing an audience. And I don't think the music theatre audience of tomorrow is being bred, right?
Well, you're having but sort let, of let this not be said. Important. I mean, yeah. I'm not defending this in any respect, but as far as I can tell, We Will Rock You is in its own way a fairly radical musical. I mean, it is an attempt to take this audience, which I don't think did go to theater very well. I mean, the people who were going to see Queen at Wembley Stadium were not necessarily coming to, you know, go see Phantom of the Opera. I think they were, mm-hmm. you know, a different crowd. And in that the producers of that were visionary enough to say that is our demographic and it is not being served in some respect, and we think it can be with this product. I think you have to pay that its respect. You don't have to say it's good, and I'd rather you didn't. But you do have to sort of acknowledge that it is a commercial producer's responsibility in a commercial environment to define their demographic and to sell to it.
Yeah, but I think a show like that ultimately has diminishing returns because it doesn't, not at the box office, obviously, in the short term, but I think it doesn't, a show like We Will Rock You doesn't train up an audience to, or give them any indication of the true possibility of what theatre or art generally or human beings can do. It just confirms.
It only trains them to see Tonight's the Night.
I'm afraid I don't subscribe to the concept of training up audiences. I don't think there's any notable decline in theatre going. I think that the experience of going to the theatre is something that fundamentally doesn't appeal to a certain age group. I think there's a cycle of theatre going. As a young person, you're taken to see children's shows. Pantomime at school, you're taken to see the Shakespeare being done at the RSC or by the local theatre.
And then you stop going for a bit
because you're growing up, you're becoming a teenager, you want to use mobile phones, which you're not allowed to do, or snog in the back row, which you're not allowed to do in the theatre. Then you start a family and start taking your own kids to the theatre and to the pantomimes and so on, and then see what's going on there, perhaps get attracted back to the theatre, and then become an adult theatre goer. And I think it's a bit of a red herring, this, and I mean, the commercial sector certainly has no obligations in that respect. It's a very short-term industry, and the idea that you could convince any commercial theatre producer, you know, to invest in, you know, nurturing and growing a theatre-going generation would not be of interest, because all that is of interest is the product at the time. And you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with the idea that theatre-going is a sort of lifestyle decision that appeals to certain age groups.
Although audience development is something that Ambassador Theatre Group, for example, do put a lot of energy into. But talking of audience development, yes. Can we open it out to questions?